Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this lecture here in Woolston College. My name is Dennis Galligan, Professor of Socio-Legal Studies in the University and a Fellow of Woolston. So tonight we are marking the sad departure of a colleague, Max Watson, who just 2 years ago was giving a lecture here in this very hall, and it never crossed our minds at the time that he would not be with us 2 years later. But we're here to celebrate Max in a way, and we have created this lecture in order to do that. So each year there will be a lecture in Max's honour here in Woolston College. Before I say a word about Max, I'd just like to introduce the institutional arrangements. So the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society is an independent institution associated with the college. It's also associated with the Centre for Socio-Legal Studies. So at the Foundation, our object is to make the results of academic research more readily available to a wider audience of professionals, business, lawyers, government, and the general public. And we've been going for 10 years now, and if you like to look at the fljs.org website, you'll see the activities we've had over that period. And so it is a really a next step along, I think, to have this annual lecture in honour of Max Watson. So Max came to Oxford quite late in his long career. Indeed, I think he had the intention of retiring to Oxford after a very prominent career in various international organisations. Finally, I think he might probably object to my saying it, his last was to save the Irish economy from disaster by way of his membership of the Central Bank of Ireland. Before that, he was working for the European Commission, and before that in other organisations, particularly the IMF, where he spent much of his career. But Max did anything but retire. He came to Oxford and threw himself into a very busy academic and academic-related life, both here at this college, both at St. Anthony's and here at this college, Woolston, where he arranged and organised and to some degree funded a range of seminars of great importance. So I would like to just acknowledge Max's contribution and to say how much we have missed him as a colleague. He was particularly active here in Woolston in the activities of the cluster, the research cluster in law, justice and society, which is funded by the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society. He was a member of our board and a very active participant in the college. He sat on the investment committee and various other committees at various times, and overall was a model member of an Oxford college. Well, moving now to our lecturer this evening, Professor Eric Heinzer, who is Professor of Law and Humanities at Queen Mary College, London, where I believe he's been since he was a boy, and he's now grown into a very mature and internationally recognised professor with a very particular and original mind, as we shall see. Eric has worked in a whole range of institutions. He studied in a quintessentially European character, I suppose. He studied in Paris, Berlin, Leiden, and even spent a bit of time in the United States in Boston University. He's written very extensively. I won't even begin to read out his long list of, even if I just gave you his books, it would take too long. And I'm green with envy. It takes me 10 years to write a book, so I don't know how he does it. But anyhow, I just mentioned two of his most recent books. First of all, The Concept of Injustice in 2013, which is really a quite important book in developing ideas of injustice. Not justice, but injustice. And I'd recommend that to you. His most recent book, and the subject of this evening's speech, is Hate Speech and Democratic Citizenship, which I think has just come out. So Eric, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to Oxford. You have been here once before in one of our previous occasions. You had a minor role there. Tonight you have the the lead role, and we very much look forward to your lecture. Thank you.
Well, thank you very, very much, Dennis. And of course, I'd like to thank also, in addition to Professor Galligan, Phil Dines and Judy Niner for having been so hospitable and welcoming me here. And it's lovely to be back here again in this lovely auditorium. The book is not quite out yet, but this is sort of my trial run before it does appear, which will be early 2016. And I'm going to start just by looking very briefly at concepts which I think will be familiar to most everyone, namely our contemporary notions of human rights, which trace, among other things, back to the 18th century bills and declarations of rights which are composed in a sort of familiar, you might say, checklist format. 2 centuries after these 18th century instruments, there's still often disagreement about their precise content. One of the most famous and still, you might say, ongoing debates, for example, is about whether we should include social and economic rights on par with civil and political rights. That is not a topic I'm going to address at all. But however you might define whatever you think ought to be in a corpus of human rights, if you believe in such a thing, one of the things that this 18th century model gives us is the idea of rights as co-equal and incommensurable. In order to explain this idea of rights, of foundational rights, of higher order rights, as co-equal and incommensurable, I would compare it, for example, to what a legislature might do when it simply has to adopt some sort of budget. Right, when it has to adopt a budget, there are going to be different items and there's going to be trade-offs, right? We'll spend perhaps a bit more on transportation and save a little bit on hospitals or the way these things are routinely done. And that's exactly how we don't imagine human rights. For example, it would be inconceivable, it would be contrary to the very idea of human rights for a government to say, for example, well, we will allow now fairer trials or secure greater fairness at the trial stage, but in exchange we'd like to do some more torture, right? That's not how we conceive of rights. That would be contrary to their very meaning. And that's what I mean by rights as being incommensurable and co-equal in status. And it may, of course, be there might be a few crits among you or communitarians who don't believe in higher order rights at all, or just sort of radical Republicans. And yet, I doubt that there's anyone among you, or if there is someone, let me know. I'd be very interested to talk to you. I doubt that there's anyone among you who would entirely abrogate or abolish all higher order or higher law restrictions on the state, restrictions on government. In other words, I don't think there would be many among you who would advocate a crude majoritarianism, even the kind where simply by majority vote, some legislative body or the people could vote even to kill, right, and kind of genocidally some minority. I doubt that there are many of you who would go along with that kind of crude majoritarian model of democracy. And it's that higher order limit on democratic processes which I want to focus on tonight, whether you call them human rights or civil rights or constitutional rights, or whether you have some other conception of them. It's the higher order quality that I want to look at this evening. Because I want to use this problem of hate speech in order to challenge this inherited co-equality or incommensurability model. I'm not quite going to argue that free speech is more important than other interests. In a sense, we know that would be absurd. You have to eat, you have to drink, and certainly you don't want to be tortured. So I'm not going to argue that free speech is more important. I am, however, going to argue that among all of these rights or higher order interests, as I actually prefer to call them, free speech is the most distinctly democratic. In fact, I would go so far as to say it is the only distinctly democratic of them. And that's the case I have to make to you tonight. Comparing again free expression or free speech to some of these other higher order interests. If a state shows, China, Saudi Arabia, whichever you like, if a state shows that it is torturing less, or that it is providing greater access to food or water, that is a way in which it shows that it's fulfilling certain human rights standards. In other words, in so doing, it legitimates itself as a state, but in no way legitimates itself as a democracy. None of those things are democratizing measures, even though we might think that they're still very good. And this is the distinction I want to make between legitimating a state as a state and legitimating it as a democracy. In fact, I think that distinction has been wholly overlooked to the great detriment of the human rights movement, but that's another topic, that's another article. So I'm going to try to make this argument as far as one can, and I realize the hazards of doing so, but as far as one can from the perspective of democracy generally. Of course, that's not an evident starting point because democracies are vastly different in how they organize themselves normatively, institutionally, procedurally, but that is going to be my ambition. And incidentally, I'm going to argue, if you want a bit of Kantian language, in a hypothetical and not a categorical mode. In other words, I'm not going to assume that democracy is the best form of government. That's just another argument. That's another debate, that's another lecture. I'm simply going to ask what is required, what is assumed if we are to have a democracy. So I'm arguing in hypothetical mode. Whether you happen to like democracy or not, again, that's another question. By democracy, we mean, in the modern age, constitutional democracy. We don't have anything like an Athenian direct democracy, and even how direct Athenian democracy was is a matter of debate. When I say that we know democracy in the modern world as constitutional, well, that means several things. One thing it means is that we accept some sort of idea that it is at times legitimate to de-democratize, to limit democracy in order to safeguard democracy. This we know, for example, from our constitutional separations of powers that we find in one form or another throughout democracies. The classic example would be that we, unlike ancient Athens, for example, we vastly de-democratize the judiciary, right? We don't put someone on trial in front of a legislative body and have everyone take a vote, or in front of a sort of a popular referendum. No, we de-democratize the judiciary, keeping it heavily under, for example, a judge's control, in order to safeguard the citizen, right? This is the kind of conventional story, to safeguard the citizen from the dangers of mob rule, of prejudice, and so forth. How well that works is another question. And so with other forms of separations of powers, we sometimes de-democratize in order to safeguard democracy. And this is how at least some human rights, certainly civil and political rights, are sometimes explained, right? In other words, we can't, within a human rights regime, a human rights-based democracy, we can't vote to re-implement torture. Right, the idea of a right against torture de-democratizes that, and so with every other kind of right. Again, this is a familiar story, and the same applies to freedom of expression. The idea, the classical idea behind freedom of expression, is that we give people a right of free expression so that we can't have a democratic majority voting to silence the person. So that, again, is seen as a de-democratizing, as a limit on democracy in order to safeguard democracy, to make sure everyone can participate. Curiously, this is also the rationale behind hate speech bans. Not always the first rationale you'll read, for example, among scholars or experts, but sooner or later, and particularly in judicial writing, this rationale always seems to be driving, to be underlining other rationales. Namely, sometimes it's desirable, indeed necessary, to limit speech in order to safeguard democracy or to safeguard the equal integrity or respect among all citizens. There are various formulations. So we have a bit of a curious dilemma here. Both the freedom of expression, the right of free expression, and the hate speech ban, they are both presented, justified as limits on democracy which are designed to safeguard or even to promote democracy. And so, how then do we resolve, right, these are the same rationale being applied to competing interests? Well, of course, the standard answer, both in theory and in the practice of most democracies, is that we simply balance them. Right, that we submit this rather typical sort of legal or political tension, as there are hundreds, to our customary processes of legislative and judicial balancing. So that's what I want to examine, this balance. What is the legitimacy, what is the foundation of this balancing? What do we understand by it? I'm going to leave that question hanging for a minute, just because before addressing it, I'd like to just go through a bit of vocabulary, just go through a few basic concepts. So we'll just keep that on the back burner for a moment. Because I want to be a bit clear about what I mean by a hate speech ban, and where in particular I find that it raises questions or problems about democracy. When I speak about a hate speech ban, well, first of all, I don't only mean speech, I mean speech or expression. This is usually how the bans are construed, and particularly in jurisdictions with more expansive bans, Germany, Scandinavian jurisdictions, the Netherlands, and so forth. So when I say hate speech, which is the more common phrase, nevertheless, I mean hateful expression. And I mean it in the sphere of what is called public discourse, the paradigm case of which would be something like general statements made in general public fora. There can be debate every now and then, is such and such a venue really a public forum? These debates come up all the time. But every democracy, if we recognize it as somehow reasonably democratic, would almost by definition have to have some sort of public forum, a space in which ideas are exchanged for general public expression and consumption. And so by a public forum or public discourse, I don't mean, therefore, kind of individually targeted acts of harassment, stalking, or what's sometimes called in the literature fighting words, right? Just haphazardly, randomly to somebody individually on the street shouting some sort of invective. And this is where my focus on democracy, I think, leads to a very different theory and a very different result from what you might call the more mediatized libertarian view, which only looks at free expression as a whole, which doesn't look at different sorts of modes of expression. And so I'm not at all here to defend sort of, you know, casual invective, even if it's in a public place. Public discourse is not equivalent to everything that's said in a public space. public discourse does not generally cover, although again there can be exceptions, workplace or primary education. Right, the workplace is always a place of very regulated speech, right? I mean, you go into any restaurant and you'll see a waiter or a waitress has to say please and thank you and, you know, how's your dinner and these sorts of things. And, you know, I mean, they can't even be rude to you without putting their job at risk, let alone racist. Or, right, so these are all, right, so the employment context conventionally, I mean, I know there are many different employment scenarios, but the conventional, typical, you know, what most people who are not like us do is always a venue of very regulated speech, and so regulating hate speech within that context is not a problem at all, or rarely, unless, again, some sort of public discourse is identifiable within the employment situation. And again, I would say primary education for the youngest cannot really be called a sphere which we would call primarily one of public discourse. Quite the contrary, it's a sphere of brainwashing. And most of you want that for your kids. You'll tell me if you don't think that's true. Universities are something different. Universities are absolutely spheres of public discourse, which is why I disagree with the policies of just about every university you can find. But more on that later. And similarly, by public discourse, I don't mean individually targeted defamation. Again, defamation of private persons who are individually ascertainable, individually identifiable. Although I would distinguish what's I think commonly called group defamation, and that's a group defamation ban is really just a kind of hate speech ban, or public persons. I think public persons actually need to have a different status, but I'm not going to go further into that, although I'm happy to talk about it later if you'd like, because I want to get back to the primary problem of hate speech within public discourse. And so, having gone through those few little definitions and qualifications, I'm interested in a hate speech ban as a viewpoint selective penalty imposed upon expression within public discourse. Again, I'm interested in a ban as a viewpoint selective penalty imposed upon expression within public discourse. In other words, speech or expression which is punished because of the worldview, the viewpoint that it expresses, and not because of the noise volume or something like that. All right, having just clarified, I hope, as you can see, these concepts are very tricky, and we can get back to them if you'd like, but having at least clarified some of them as best I can, I want to get back to this question that I left hanging, which is kind of the question, right? This idea of, are we really talking about balancing, which is, I think, the conventional view, a right against certain necessary or admitted restrictions? That would certainly be the dominant approach in most Western democracies, the US being a notorious example. But the dominant approach in all other Western democracies, I would call loosely one of value pluralism. In other words, it's simply accepted that in a democratic society, we have conflicting values, and so the whole purpose of legislatures, and to some degree courts or other bodies, is simply to balance competing interests. So in a sense, what courts and legislatures are doing in the realm of speech would seem to be self-evident, at least in principle, even if we disagree with particular results. Within the sphere of what I'm calling value pluralism, you could say that we do inject rights, right? Again, a right to free expression. So we conventionally approach this problem within most democracies in a context of rights-based value pluralism. And that is the legitimacy of which I'm challenging. Oh God, that sentence is not good at all. I'm challenging the legitimacy of rights-based value pluralism as the dominant means by which we settle these questions about freedom of expression and its limits. What justifies that balancing? Again, the kind of obvious answer would be, well, this is what legislatures and courts are always doing. They're there to balance conflicting interests. In other words, the conventional answer would be that these processes are self-justifying, right? Oh, that's why we have democracy. If you don't like it, you go, you speak about it, you change it. But I think conventional theory is that a democracy is self-justifying. Now, I think people like Rawls and Dworkin in the post-war era saw a problem with the idea of democracy as a purely self-justifying system. If a democracy were purely self-justifying, that means those with decision-making authority could always vote on even what democracy is, even on its definition, and that can lead us into some absurdities. Right, and who's to say that the People's Republic, the Democratic Republic of Korea or the old German Democratic Republic are not democracies, right? But if we have an idea of a sham democracy, of a democracy which is not somehow genuine, then it must be because a democracy cannot be wholly self-justifying. There must be certain values which justify democracy and which democracy itself cannot alter or change. That's what I think, and that's what I'm going to try now to explain. Every democratic constitution has provisions for its own abolition or amendment. But how would that abolition or amendment take place? That abolition or amendment has to itself draw on public discourse. One decisive manifestation of public discourse is, of course, voting. Again, voting is how we conventionally define democracy, but voting is itself simply one formalized procedure for speaking. And so the very possibility of ever changing a democracy, or indeed abolishing it, itself would always be depending on public discourse. Public discourse is, in other words, not temporally, not chronologically, not literally, but conceptually prior to democracy itself. And so the character of public discourse, I'm arguing, as an arena, a sphere of viewpoints and of their exchange, is conceptually prior to democracy and is what legitimates democracy. It's not something that a democratic body can legitimately change or alter, again, with respect to viewpoints. It is public discourse which constitutes democracy, and therefore a democratic process cannot legitimately constitute public discourse. To formulate this with slightly different words, I'm arguing that a necessary condition of democratic legitimacy is what I'll call the citizen's prerogative of non-viewpoint punitive expression within public discourse. I'll say that again. The necessary condition of democratic legitimacy is the citizen's prerogative of non-viewpoint punitive expression within public discourse. And I've given this legitimating condition a name, which I call viewpoint absolutism, or viewpoint absolutism within public discourse, or within democratic public discourse. You'll notice, perhaps, that I'm trying to replace the much more common and wholly absurd notion of free speech absolutism. There is no such thing, and there couldn't be. The idea that free speech cannot be absolute is not an observation, it is a tautology. For the simple reason that if free speech were literally absolute, I could kill someone, I could refuse to pay my taxes, I could explode nuclear material, I could do whatever I want and avoid punishment because I could say, well, I was doing it to make a statement. Otherwise, absolute means nothing. In other words, an absolute individual freedom of expression would overthrow any legal system. So any legal system, by definition, tautologically, has to assume that a freedom of expression must have limits. So the phrase free speech absolutism should just be abolished from the lexicon. It only confuses people, and people call themselves free speech absolutists, even if they're libertarians, and again, I'm distancing myself from the libertarian position, are speaking nonsense. Rather, viewpoint absolutism, I think, does capture the position which I'm defending as a necessary condition for democratic legitimacy, viewpoint absolutism within the sphere of public discourse. Now, up until now, I've been speaking to you solely in terms of principles. You might say I've been making a purely deontological argument, which leaves a few things unresolved. First of all, are there any objections to my position, even in principle, deontological objections? And second, are there any consequentialist objections, right? Namely, the reason probably most of you are here, and maybe some of you baffled about what I've been talking about for the last 20 minutes, you know, many of you just want to know, you know, is this stuff dangerous? Is it harmful? What risks does it pose? And do I have anything to say about that? And you're absolutely right to think that and to worry about that. Everything I've said up until now is of no interest whatsoever if those questions cannot be addressed. Just to kind of tidy up first on the questions of principle, the deontological questions, a position has emerged which has in recent years been labeled a dignitarian, which says, well, wait a minute. Yes, free expression is certainly a kind of condition for democracy, but so is mutual or equal respect among citizens. How could you have a democracy without some baseline of respect? And of course, that's a very legitimate concern. The problem, again, people like Jeremy Waldron like this argument, and there are a few others. Jeremy Waldron is a good example because you never find his dignitarian principle. It's alluded to and urged and sort of sketched and painted, but it is wholly lacks any circumscription. For good reason, because it cannot be circumscribed. There are all sorts of ways in which citizens may fail to show respect for each other, way beyond the ambit of hate speech bans. And so, if a hate speech ban is meant to vindicate that interest, it leaves that interest wholly unvindicated or wholly arbitrarily vindicated, and, which is simply to say that it's really trying to get at something else. And then the question is, well, what else? It's not then about respecting citizens. If we were to seriously implement the idea, a legally underpinned and a higher order interest in mutual respect, that would essentially annihilate the idea, the possibility of free expression. And so I think this is the constant problem with the dignitarian argument, which is why the dignitarian schools neither give us satisfactory notions of dignity. They usually just refer to very bad readings of the German constitution. And again, give us no idea of where dignity starts and stops, because again, if you were to take that idea seriously, free expression could not be a higher order interest at all. I don't know how much time I have. Another 5 minutes, or? Yeah, all right, okay. Yeah, I'm happy to leave more time for conversation anyway. But I do also want to get to the consequentialist or empirical questions again, which are usually the first. Most people don't start the way I've started. Most people start very concretely, and again, for very good reasons. We see this problem in the newspapers, on television every day, right? We see it even here in our university environments. And so I can understand entirely that you might be saying, well, yeah, all this principle is nice, but is there a problem? Is there a danger? And particularly on the continent, but you read it in a lot of the literature and occasionally in a court judgment, you might call a classic consequentialist argument in this area is based in 20th century history. Again, in Germany, you will hear this argument constantly. You just have to almost open up any newspaper or listen to any television or radio debate on this, and within 2 minutes, obviously, the Holocaust is at issue, and the point is made and repeated, right, that hate speech in the Weimar Republic didn't just stop at speech, that it led to some of the 20th century's great atrocities. And we hear this argument again with respect to places like the former Yugoslavia or Rwanda, right? And each time we're told, you know, these were democracies. Democracies could not prevent great atrocities resulting from free speech. And I think those arguments actually make a very, very big mistake. They make a mistake which we actually find on both sides of the argument. We find Ronald Dworkin making this mistake, just as we find advocates and defenders of hate speech bound to make the mistake. And the mistake is to assume a kind of one-size-fits-all model of democracy. In other words, it's what we could call an inductive fallacy, the idea that we could find this danger in one or two or three on-paper democracies means that this is a systemic problem or danger within democracies. What I argue is, no, we have to understand that democracies, right, even though democracy as a concept might require certain legitimating conditions, as I've tried to outline in the deontological part of the discussion, that doesn't mean that all democracies at all stages of their history can always realize all of their legitimating conditions. I mean, the Weimar Republic is a famous example of a place which was barely a democracy. Most of the people in the Weimar Parliament actually were only there to try to dismantle the democracy. But I won't go into that history for now. I'm arguing that since about the 1960s, we can witness the emergence of a very, very different kind of model of democracy, which is very, very different from the Weimar type. I call it, and I know that these adjectives are all very loaded, so I need to spend a lot of time explaining them. I'll just try to do so briefly now. I call it the model of the long-standing, stable, and prosperous democracy. When I say long-standing, I don't necessarily mean a particular time frame. I mean enough time for democracy, for certain democratic values, habits, norms, practices, attitudes to have disseminated within a substantial portion of the population. This was entirely missing in Weimar Germany. There was no such history of democratic culture at all. When I say stable, I mean stable enough to be able to protect its vulnerable citizens in other ways without having to curb speakers. And when I say prosperous, it's a similar standard, also having the resources, the material means of protecting the targets, the vulnerable targets of hatred, without having to curb speakers, without having to shut people up. In other words, once again, I'm assuming a model of the state which is not at all libertarian, although I feel it's intensely democratic. It requires a very active state. It requires a state which does take positions. In other words, another big mistake in the literature, again, people like Waldron make this mistake, is the idea that if you oppose hate speech bans, you're assuming a value-neutral state. First of all, the idea of a value-neutral state is an absurdity. Even the most libertarian state can't be value-neutral. Its values are libertarian, and it's doing and saying that every minute, if there were such a thing as a libertarian state. There's no such thing as a value-neutral state. The fact that the state has no legitimacy, or I should say the long-standing, stable, and prosperous democracy has no legitimacy in silencing speakers within public discourse on viewpoint selective grounds, does not mean that the state itself cannot take its own position. Quite the contrary. The state can and does constantly take positions. Anti-discrimination laws at the workplace and education and so forth, these are not only effective means for, I don't mean they always work, I mean they're meant to do something, to have effect. And these, right, so these are not only meant to be effective within these sorts of educational or employment situations or for the delivery of goods and services, but they are also ways in which the state makes a statement, takes a position. And there are many other examples of ways in which the state is by no means value neutral and does not have to be value neutral. The only legitimating criterion that I'm trying to introduce is that the state can, should, must, if it's a long-standing, stable, and prosperous democracy, take very active positions, stances, policies against discrimination, against hatred, but cannot legitimately punish those who disagree, however crudely, within public discourse. However, there's a bit more to the consequentialism, if you're still not convinced. I think, particularly in the English-speaking world, people lean very heavily on these consequentialist arguments, precisely because in the English-speaking world, hate speech bans tend to be implemented with a certain hesitation. If you look at evidence from states like Germany and France, which are a particular interest of mine, although I've also looked at jurisdictions such as the Netherlands and some Scandinavian ones. In other words, I've looked at jurisdictions which really have very comprehensive hate speech bans and keep expanding them ever since about the 1980s. And you could not have a worse case for a consequentialist argument, because in all of those states, in tandem with the expansion of hate speech bans and their implementation, we find more and more hate speech. So if you don't like any of the other arguments I've made so far, you just find them a bit boring, I think it is very hard to make the case that these bans work. Levels of hate speech in places like Germany and France are at least as high as in any English-speaking country, and one might make the case even higher, letting aside the fact that they're hate groups are far better organized, and so again, there's a big question. Once we get into something like a long-standing, stable, and prosperous democracy, I think there's an enormous question about whether it is the kind of state that has the social dynamics which, on the one hand, can far better combat problems of hatred without silencing speakers, and which, on the other hand, might actually be provoking hatred through these sorts of bans, as I think much of the evidence suggests. I could go on forever, but I think actually it'd be far more interesting now for me to stop for a moment and maybe for the discussion to begin, because I'd very much like to hear people's opinions.